Ever get that feeling where you're reading the same sentence yeah. over and over and over?
Oh, yeah.
But it just isn't clicking?
Absolutely.
Like, what are they trying to say?
Yeah.
Well, today's deep dive is all about cracking that code. We are tackling authorial intent.
Ooh.
It's basically figuring out what an author really meant.
Right.
Not just what the words seem to say mm-hmm. on the surface.
Yeah.
And trust me, this is way more relevant to your life.
Oh, yeah.
Than you might think at first.
This isn't just for analyzing dusty old books.
Right.
Understanding authorial intent helps you in everyday situations.
Mm.
Deciphering a tricky work email,
mm-hmm.
making sure you really understand a contract before you sign it.
Oh, for sure.
Even figuring out what that cryptic social media post from your friend actually means.
Okay. So we're all about becoming master decoders of meaning here.
That's right.
And to guide us on this mission, we've got excerpts from Dr. Dave Matthewson's lecture on hermeneutics.
Okay.
Specifically, lecture 12.
Where he really gets deep into text-centered approaches.
Mm-hmm.
The big question is, can't we really get inside an author's head?
Right.
Especially if they lived centuries ago.
Well, Matthewson kicks things off by diving into the world of biblical studies.
Okay.
Where authorial intent has been a huge battleground.
I can imagine.
Imagine believing that the Bible is the word of God.
Mm-hmm.
Suddenly, figuring out what the author meant
right.
isn't just an academic exercise.
Yeah.
It's about understanding the divine message itself.
So the stakes are pretty high.
Very high.
If you're approaching the Bible that way.
Yes.
But wouldn't things get messy quickly?
For sure.
After all, people interpret things differently all the time.
Exactly. And that's where Matthewson brings in a helpful distinction.
Okay.
From scholar E.D. Hirsch.
Mm-hmm.
The difference between meaning,
okay.
what the author intended,
yeah.
and significance, which is how we apply that meaning today.
Okay.
The meaning is fixed.
Like a time capsule from the past.
Uh-huh.
The significance can change as our world changes.
So even if something was written hundreds of years ago.
Right.
Its meaning is still locked in time.
It is.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
But let's bring this to the present.
Okay.
Okay. So think about a law
okay.
passed decades ago.
Mm-hmm.
Something about, say, regulating telegrams.
Oh.
Back then, that was cutting-edge communication.
Yes.
Like super high-tech. Right.
I see where you're going with this.
Yeah.
Today, we might apply that same law to text messages or emails.
Right.
Even though the original authors never even dreamed of those technologies.
They had no idea.
But the original intent of the law,
mm-hmm.
what problem it was trying to solve,
mm-hmm.
that remains the same.
Right.
And understanding that is crucial
yeah.
for applying it fairly and effectively.
Okay, that makes sense. But Matthewson also talks about some major pushback yeah. against this whole idea of authorial intent. It's not exactly easy to mind meld with someone long gone, right?
You're hitting on a common objection.
Yeah.
People say, you can't get inside a dead author's head.
Right.
It's impossible.
Yeah.
Matthewson even shares a funny story about a scholar who completely forgot.
Oh, no.
The intended meaning of his own book.
Really?
Years later.
Wow.
Then you've got situations with authors who might just be bad communicators.
Yeah.
Or times when what they say has a deeper meaning than they even realized at the time.
So how do we even begin to untangle all of that? It sounds like trying to solve a mystery with half the pieces missing.
It's definitely a challenge.
Yeah.
But just because something is difficult doesn't mean it's impossible.
Right.
Think of it like a detective investigating a crime scene.
Okay.
They might not have all the answers right away,
mm-hmm.
but by carefully examining the evidence,
yeah.
they can build a case.
Mm-hmm.
We have tools and methods.
Okay.
Looking at the historical context,
mm-hmm.
understanding the author's background,
mm-hmm.
analyzing the language and structure of the text.
Yeah.
All of these help increase our chances of understanding the author's intent.
So it's less about mind reading.
Exactly.
And more about being a good detective.
That's a great way to put it.
That makes me feel a little better about our chances here.
We're not after the author's exact psychological state.
Yeah.
It's more about uncovering the meaning embedded in the words themselves.
It's about figuring out what they intended to put on the page.
Yes.
Not what we think they might have been thinking in the process.
Right.
That makes a lot of sense.
We're aiming for a substantial and adequate understanding.
Okay.
Not absolute perfection.
Okay. That feels like a good goal to shoot for.
Yeah.
Matthewson brings up some intriguing examples
yeah.
from the Bible to really hammer home this debate
yeah.
about authorial intent.
Right.
He talks about Genesis 1 and 2,
mm-hmm.
the two creation accounts.
Right.
Which is fascinating to me.
You've got source critics who might try to break down these accounts, arguing they come from different sources and were woven together later.
Okay.
Then you have literary critics who focus on the overall literary unity of the text, looking for recurring themes and overarching messages.
Like two different lenses focusing on the same object.
Precisely.
Right.
Yes.
You're going to see different things depending on which lens you use.
Exactly.
Right.
Mathewson then points to the Book of Ruth.
Oh, okay.
A book many find fascinating.
Mm-hmm.
Now, some scholars might get hung up on whether Ruth was a real historical figure or a literary creation.
Yeah.
But a literary critic is less concerned with that debate.
Okay.
They're more interested in the story itself.
Okay.
The characters, the plot, how all those elements work together to create a meaningful narrative.
And we can't leave out Jesus's parables, which are always a crowd favorite.
Yes.
Mathewson uses these as a prime example
yep.
of how literary analysis can help us unlock a deeper understanding.
Absolutely.
Right.
It's not just about what happens in the story, but how it's told.
Right.
Literary critics look at the structure of the parable, the symbolism, the characters, the unexpected twists.
Yeah.
All of these details offer clues to what Jesus might have been trying to convey.
It's like he was intentionally crafting these stories with hidden depths.
Yes.
Knowing that future generations would be trying to decode them.
And here's where the role of the reader becomes crucial.
Oh, okay.
Mathewson is a big advocate for active reading.
Okay.
We can't just sit back and passively absorb the text.
Right.
We need to engage with it, wrestle with it, ask questions, and be open to being challenged.
So it's a two-way street.
Exactly.
We bring our own experiences and perspectives to the table.
Mm-hmm.
But the text can also push back.
Right.
And make us see things in a new light. Okay.
It's a dialogue.
Uh-huh.
A conversation between the reader and the text.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where it gets really exciting.
Okay.
But before we jump into that.
Yeah.
Let's pause here.
Okay. So we're not just passive sponges soaking up words on a page.
Right.
We're active participants in this whole meaning-making process.
Yes.
I like that.
Yeah.
It feels more empowering.
It is empowering.
Yeah.
Because it means you're not just at the mercy of the text.
Right.
You bring something valuable to the table.
Uh-huh.
Your own unique perspective.
Yeah.
Your experiences, your questions.
Yeah.
But at the same time, the text can challenge those perspectives.
Mm-hmm.
Broaden your horizons and maybe even change your mind about something.
That's what makes reading and learning so interesting, right? It's not a one-way street.
Yeah.
Mathewson takes us even deeper into this idea
by
highlighting how different schools of thought have approached this whole question of authorial intent.
Yeah.
He talks about historical criticism, literary criticism, and even mentions something called formalism or new criticism.
Right.
It sounds like a whole buffet of approaches to choose from.
Each one offers a different lens for looking at a text.
Okay.
Historical criticism, as you might guess, is all about understanding the historical context.
Right.
Who wrote the text? When? Yeah. What was happening in the world at that time?
Right.
How might those factors have influenced what the author was trying to say?
So it's like trying to understand a letter from a friend
without
knowing anything about their life or what they've been going through.
Right.
You might miss some crucial context.
Exactly.
Right.
Literary criticism, on the other hand, shifts the focus to the text itself as a work of art.
Okay.
It looks at things like plot character development themes, symbolism,
all
those elements that make a story come alive.
Okay.
And then you have formalism, which takes that idea even further. Formalists argue that the text is a self-contained universe of meaning.
Okay.
We should focus on the words on the page, the structure, the literary devices, and not get bogged down by external factors, like the author's biography or the historical context.
So it's like judging a painting purely on its visual elements.
Yeah.
The colors, composition, brushstrokes.
Exactly.
Without worrying about who painted it or why.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah.
And this shift towards literary approaches in the 20th century really shook things up in the field of biblical studies.
Okay.
For example, scholars started looking at Old Testament narratives, like the Book of Job, through a purely literary lens.
Interesting.
Instead of getting caught up in debates about whether Job was a real person or whether the events actually happened.
Yeah.
They focused on the literary artistry, the powerful themes of suffering and faith, the way the story is structured to create tension and drama.
It's like treating the Bible as a collection of Shakespearean plays or epic poems.
Exactly. And this approach wasn't limited to the Old Testament.
Okay.
It also led to fascinating new analyses of Jesus's parables.
Okay.
Remember Mathewson talking about how literary criticism helps us understand their structure, whether they have one main character, two or three?
Yeah.
Those are called monadic, dyadic, and triadic parables.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah.
It's like a secret code for understanding how these stories work.
But it goes even deeper than that.
Okay.
Literary critics look at the aesthetic qualities, the vivid imagery,
right,
the way Jesus uses symbolism and unexpected twists to drive home his point.
It's like those parables were designed to grab your attention and make you really think.
Yes.
They're not just dry moral lessons.
Right. They're stories with compelling characters, dramatic tension, and often a surprise ending that makes you question your assumptions.
Right.
Like in the parable of the prodigal son.
Mm-hmm.
No self-respecting father in those days would run to greet his wayward son like that.
Right.
It just wasn't done.
Yeah. Yeah.
But that detail is there to shock you.
Yeah.
To make you question your own preconceived notions about forgiveness and unconditional love.
It's like Jesus was saying, hey, wake up.
Exactly.
I'm not playing by your rules.
Right.
I'm offering something radical and new.
Exactly.
Right.
And all these examples highlight how these text-centered approaches opened up new and exciting ways of reading and appreciating the Bible, revealing layers of meaning that might have been missed before.
But with all these different approaches swirling around, it seems like things could get pretty subjective.
Right.
How do we keep from getting lost in a sea of interpretations?
Yeah.
Is there any anchor, any way to ground our understanding?
That's the million-dollar question, right?
Yeah.
And Mathewson acknowledges this challenge head-on.
Okay.
He emphasizes that while we need to be aware of our own presuppositions and biases, we can't just throw out the baby with the bathwater.
Right.
We can't completely abandon the idea of authorial intent.
Yeah.
Just because it's complex and sometimes elusive.
So we can't just make the text mean whatever we want it to mean.
Exactly.
There are some boundaries, some rules of the game.
He argues that even though we can't perfectly reconstruct the author's mind, we can still aim for a substantial and adequate understanding of their intended meaning.
Right.
We can use all those tools we talked about earlier, looking at the historical context,
right,
the author's background,
right,
the language of the text,
yeah,
to get as close as we can to what they were trying to communicate.
So it's like trying to get as close as we can to the truth.
Exactly.
Acknowledging that there might be some things we'll never fully know.
Precisely.
Right.
And to do that, Mathewson reminds us that we need to be active and creative readers.
Yeah.
We have to engage with the text, wrestle with it, and allow it to challenge our own perspectives.
It's like a two-way conversation, right?
Exactly.
We bring our own questions and experiences to the table.
Yes.
But the text pushes back and makes us see things in a new light.
Exactly. And that's where things get really interesting.
Okay.
Mathewson argues that any interpretation is valid as long as it can be justified by the text itself.
Uh-huh.
The author of the Discorium, the historical context, and the intended audience.
Okay.
It's not a free-for-all, but it does allow for a certain degree of flexibility and nuance.
So we can't just impose our own modern-day ideas onto the text.
Right.
We have to try and understand it within its original context.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that means taking into account the historical, cultural, and social norms of the time.
Right.
The language being used, the literary genre, and the author's likely intentions.
It's like trying to understand a joke from a different culture.
Yes.
You need to know the background and the context to get the humor.
That's a perfect analogy.
Right.
And Mathewson provides some helpful guidelines for navigating this complex process.
Okay.
He suggests that we ask ourselves a series of questions.
Okay.
First, what could be justified from the text itself?
Uh-huh.
What are the words actually saying? What's the grammar and structure of the text telling us?
Okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
We need to start with the text itself.
Yes.
Not our own preconceived notions.
Right.
What else should we be asking?
Well, then we should consider what we know about the author.
Okay.
Who were they? What were their beliefs and values?
Mm-hmm.
What was their purpose in writing this text?
Right.
Knowing the author's background and motivations can shed a lot of light on their intended meaning.
Right, because the same words can mean very different things.
Exactly.
Depending on who's saying them and why.
Right.
What about the audience?
Ah, yes.
Yeah.
That's another crucial piece of the puzzle.
Okay.
We need to consider the intended audience.
Okay.
Who were they?
Mm-hmm.
What were their beliefs and expectations?
Right.
How would they have understood the text?
Yeah.
A message delivered to a group of farmers in ancient Israel might be received very differently by city dwellers in 21st century America.
It's like speaking different languages, even if the words are technically the same.
And finally, we need to consider the historical and cultural context.
Okay.
What was happening in the world at the time the text was written? How might that have influenced the author and the audience's understanding?
Right.
It's like trying to piece together a puzzle, taking all these different factors into account to get a clearer picture of the author's intended meaning.
That's a great way to put it.
Yeah.
It sounds like a lot of work.
It is.
But also incredibly rewarding.
It is.
Yeah.
And while this process might seem daunting at first, Mathewson assures us that it's worth the effort.
Okay.
Because by understanding the text on its own terms, we can then begin to explore its relevance and application for our own lives today.
Right.
We move from simply decoding the meaning to actually engaging with it in a meaningful way.
So it's not just about digging into the past.
Right.
It's about connecting the dots to the present.
Yeah.
And even the future.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And then that's where things get really exciting.
Okay.
But before we jump into that, I think it's important to look at one more specific example.
Okay.
Of how literary criticism has been applied to the Bible.
Okay. I'm all ears.
He talked about something called narrative criticism.
Okay.
It's a fascinating approach that focuses specifically on biblical stories.
All right.
And how they're structured and told.
Okay. I'm intrigued. Tell me more. Narrative criticism.
Yes.
It sounds like we're about to dissect the Bible like a best-selling novel.
You got it.
Yeah.
Narrative criticism treats biblical stories as stories.
Okay.
It focuses on things like plot, character development, setting point of view, all those elements that draw us into a good book or movie.
So instead of getting bogged down in historical debates, we're looking at the nuts and bolts of storytelling.
Exactly.
Like what makes these stories tick.
Precisely.
Yeah.
And Mathewson points out that this approach can be incredibly insightful.
Okay.
When it comes to understanding the Bible, take the book of Ruth, for example. Instead of debating whether Ruth was a real person, narrative criticism would focus on her journey as a character.
Okay.
How she develops her relationship with Naomi and Boaz, the choices she makes that drive the plot forward.
It's like we're watching the story unfold before our eyes.
Yes.
Noticing the little details we might have missed before.
Exactly.
Right.
And by paying attention to the narrative techniques, we gain a deeper appreciation for the message the author is trying to convey.
Okay.
For instance, the way the story is structured.
Right.
The use of repetition, foreshadowing symbolism. All of these elements work together to create a richer meaning.
So it's not just about what happens, but how it's told.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's like the difference between a dry recounting of facts and a story that truly captures your imagination.
That's a great way to put it.
And Mathewson highlights how narrative criticism can help us uncover subtle details and nuances that we might miss on a surface. Like those aha moments when you suddenly see the story in a whole new light.
Like hidden clues that unlock a deeper layer of understanding.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Let's go back to Jesus' parables for a moment.
Okay.
Narrative criticism can help us understand why he chose certain characters and settings, why he structured the story in a particular way, and how those choices contribute to the overall message.
So it's like Jesus was a master storyteller.
Yes.
Using every element of the narrative to make a point.
Precise.
Almost like a puzzle box where each piece fits together to reveal a bigger picture.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And by paying attention to those details, we can glean a deeper understanding of his teachings.
Okay.
Take the parable of the Good Samaritan, for instance.
Okay.
It's not just a feel-good story about helping your neighbor.
Right.
It's carefully crafted to challenge our preconceived notions about who our neighbor is and what true compassion looks like. The characters, the setting, the unexpected twist, they all work together to deliver a powerful message.
It's like those parables were designed to make us stop and think.
Yes.
To challenge our assumptions about the world.
Exactly.
Right.
And narrative criticism helps us see how Jesus used the power of storytelling to do just that.
Okay, so we've covered a lot of ground here.
We have.
Authorial intent, different approaches to interpretation, historical context, literary techniques.
Yes.
What's the bottom line? What should our listener walk away with after this deep dive?
I think the biggest takeaway is that interpreting any text, especially a complex and ancient one like the Bible, is a journey, not a destination. There's no single right answer, but rather an ongoing process of discovery that involves careful observation,
right,
critical thinking,
mm-hmm.
and a willingness to engage with different perspectives.
So it's not about finding the interpretation,
right,
but rather understanding the text on its own terms,
yes.
and then figuring out what it means for us today.
Exactly. Okay, cool. Mathewson would encourage our listener to approach the Bible,
mm-hmm.
and any text for that matter,
right,
with a sense of humility, curiosity, and openness.
Uh-huh.
It's a book that has spoken to people across cultures and centuries,
mm-hmm.
and it continues to offer insights and wisdom for those who engage with it thoughtfully.
It's like a conversation that never ends.
Yes.
Each generation brings its own questions and experiences.
That's right.
And the text continues to speak in new and relevant ways.
Beautifully put. I think that's a perfect note to end on.
Well, there you have it, folks. Another deep dive complete.
Yes.
We hope you've enjoyed this exploration of authorial intent and the fascinating world of biblical interpretation.
It's been a pleasure.
Remember, it's not about finding all the answers,
right,
but about asking the right questions and engaging in a thoughtful dialogue with the text.
Exactly.
And who knows, maybe this deep dive has sparked some new questions or insights for you.
I hope so.
Keep exploring, keep questioning, and keep the conversation going.
Absolutely.